Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some top news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people. Knowledge is the best weapon. Today is Thursday, May 21st, 2026 in the Gregorian calendar and the 5th of Sivan, 5786 in the Hebrew calendar. Today we are discussing war, Israeli elections, and a scandalous National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who posted a video he shouldn't have, that he shouldn't have really participated in the first place. Our political analyst, Binyamin Moalem, will cover all of that, and stay tuned for the end of the show, where we will have a Torah thought for the holiday of Shavuot by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York. Now, let's get to the news. Binyamin Moalem is deeply engaged in Israeli current events and policy discussions. Having worked as a foreign law clerk at the Supreme Court of Israel, he has a unique vantage point on Israeli jurisprudence. Binyamin now devotes much of his time to curating and explaining current events and politics in Israel on his popular Instagram page, By Moalem, where he provides balanced news coverage from an Israeli perspective for those seeking to be informed without an extensive time investment. Binyamin has authored several thought-provoking featured op-eds and has been featured as a guest lecturer at Bar-Ilan University right here in central Israel. Let's bring him in. Welcome to the show, Binyamin Moalem, our political analyst. We're so happy to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be back.
So we are dealing with, well, my inbox is filled with questions from people asking me if we're going to be back in war with Iran. There's also a lot of news going on with the National Security Minister here, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's under fire for having really been sort of a rebel rouser with these flotilla activists that were apprehended and taken into the port of Ashdod. And so he released a video of himself. And we also have elections that are going to be early. If the parties get their way. So I think we have quite a few things to cover, both internationally and right here in the heart of Israel. So let's get started with Iran, U.S., and Israel. Is there going to be a new bout of fighting between the countries?
So I got to take out my old, my t-shirt from before the war, which said, I don't know when it's going to start. You got to get into President Trump's head. He kind of took us all by surprise when he said Monday that he had canceled a planned attack for Tuesday. Again, we kind of knew that something was coming because Iran has not moved an inch. He said that he had been convinced by Gulf states that that a deal is still possible, though we have not seen any indication at all from Iran that they are willing to move an inch in the direction of what the U.S. demands are. Now, it could be that there are things behind the scenes. We have heard reports over and over again that they're a lot more practical and reasonable when negotiating directly with the U.S. than they are in public, which could be true. But just this morning, there was a statement from Iran saying that the Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei put out a statement saying that he forbids any of Iran's stockpile of highly enriched uranium to be relinquished and sent out of Iran. And this obviously is a key U.S. demand in any deal, that the uranium that Iran has, especially the 450 kilos of highly enriched 60% uranium, which is close to weapons grade, get removed from the country. And if Iran doesn't agree to that, then there's no way we're going to get a deal. Now, Iran also has a couple tons of uranium that is enriched to levels below 60%, which is also of concern to Israel. So that's another thing that the U.S. Maybe trying to get out as well. And if Iran isn't willing to relinquish its most enriched uranium, then we probably won't have much to talk about here. So unless there's some sort of talks going on behind the scenes that we are not aware of, then it would seem that we are probably headed down the path of renewed military action. Now, there was a report yesterday in Channel 12 in Axios that President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu held a quote-unquote difficult call a couple nights ago about the future of the talks and the possible war. President Trump is still trying to get a framework, a memorandum of understanding with Iran done, meaning both Iran and the U.S. would sign this MOU. And basically it would say that the war ends, Strait of Hormuz reopens, and over the next month we're going to discuss the terms of a nuclear deal. But there would be certain parameters that Iran would have to agree to. Now, Iran has not shown any indication that it is willing to agree to any of these parameters. But if they would, Prime Minister Netanyahu did say that he, or at least the report said that the Prime Minister was, quote unquote, concerned about the framework agreement. He doesn't like what it says, according to the report. But again, there's no guarantee that Iran will agree to this. And it would seem, based on the reports from this morning, bless you, that Iran isn't willing to play ball with the United States, which leaves us with the last, with the possibility that President Trump really boxed himself in here, that he's going to have to go back to war somehow. Now, what does that war look like? Does it look like what we saw during the 40-day war a month and a half ago? Does it look something a lot less, a lot more brief? It's quite possible that President Trump wants to strike a few more targets. There were a few more targets on the list that both the U.S. and Israel have that they'd want to get taken care of. Maybe the use of ground troops in the Strait of Hormuz to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Maybe the use of ground troops for a much more complicated mission to recover that uranium that is believed to be buried deep underground in one of the nuclear sites that were destroyed in the June war last year. So a lot of options that are being looked at right now. What he ultimately does is anyone's guess.
I was really impacted by an article that I read in the New York Times right before the war began in the last session at the end of February, early March, where an Iranian professor was interviewed by the New York Times, and he said that the thing that the West doesn't understand is that the more strikes, the more military action, the more that the IRGC is going to actually double down, and basically that they are never going to concede, they are never going to give up, and they are never going to, you know, say that they're going to surrender their nuclear arms, their position. And and that really got into my head. How do you respond to that?
So that Iran is, the Iranian leadership is stubborn is has been evident over the past month and a half from the negotiations. Despite all the blows they took during the war and the economic damage that is being done to the Iranian government, to the Iranian people, they still have not budged all that much in their in the negotiations for a deal. The closest they seem to be willing to go is something along the lines of the 2015 JCPOA. But then again, now they have this stockpile of highly enriched uranium, which the U.S. cannot allow to remain in Iran. Now, the hope is that, yes, they are stubborn, but with this ongoing blockade, and this is another avenue that President Trump could pursue, is the blockade on the Strait of Hormuz of Iranian vessels or vessels that pay money to Iran in order to exit the Strait of Hormuz. This is doing significant damage to the Iranian economy, and it could, over the next weeks or months, this could cause the economy to collapse. It could cause the destruction of Iran's oil infrastructure, because once Iran runs out of places to store its oil, it will no longer be able to pump the oil. And again, I'm not familiar with the engineering specifics, but once you stop pumping oil, that causes the entire infrastructure there to break down, and then it needs to be rebuilt. And this could cost billions of dollars. So Iran is facing, you know, economic disaster. There have been reports out of Iran that they're already feeling the pressure from this economic blockade. And so the hope would be that this could ultimately lead to either, if not concessions on the part of the Iranian regime, perhaps even an internal revolt and the collapse of the regime. But you know, that would be something that takes patience on the part of President Trump. It's unclear that he has that patience, given, you know, you've got the World Cup coming up, you've got 250 celebrations in the United States, you've got high gas prices and midterm elections coming up in November that President Trump does not want to lose. And he's already losing in the polls. So these are all things that Iran thinks. And, you know, I've said this before, I say it again, this is a game of chicken between the regime and President Trump. Does President Trump have the gumption and the stomach to wait this out and wait for the, if not the regime to collapse, but the regime to come back to the table, to come crawling back and make the concessions that he's demanding? Or does the regime say, like, hey, we can wait this out. It will take a few blows. The people, we don't care about them. Ultimately, President Trump will have to make the concessions that we want, because he won't be able to keep going and survive politically, at least not in the way that he wants to, as long as we can wait this out. And Israel, the United States are saying, like, hey, well, if we also add military action to the economic blockade that we have right now, perhaps we can move this process along quicker, which is a possibility. The question is, does President Trump want to ultimately go back to war? It would seem, based on what he has been saying, that he's kind of backed himself into a corner where he will have to go back to war because Iran is not playing ball. But he has found ways to extend the ceasefire many times over the past 42 days, I believe. And it's quite possible he'll find more ways to extend it, even if Iran is not playing ball, so long as the economic blockade remains in place, which keeps the pressure on the Iranian regime.
Thanks for going through that with me, Binyamin. I want to move over to Israel, what's happening here on the ground. Take us to the political arena. What's going on with the upcoming elections?
All right, so yesterday the Knesset, there had been, for a few weeks now, there has been talks that the Haredi parties, particularly UTJ, would vote against the government and try to bring down the government because of the lack, its failure to pass a Haredi draft exemption bill for yeshiva students. Over the past 3.5 years, they had been promised this as one of the first things that would be on the agenda of the government when it was formed 3.5 years ago. That has not happened. Since then, we've had the October 7th war and the war in Iran, the war with Lebanon. There is very little appetite amongst the rest of Israel society to pass such a law. And so they've been upset that the law has not been passed, and they threaten to join the opposition in bringing down the government. Now, them alone would not be enough to bring down the government. They would also need Shas party because the government has 68 seats right now. And UTJ is only 7 members. And also UTJ is divided into 2 different factions. One faction was putting more pressure than the other faction. Anyway, Shas also wanted to get on board with that. There was a little bit of a dispute as to when the elections would be held. A lot of this was done behind closed doors. Whatever the case, the opposition put forth a motion to dissolve the Knesset yesterday. And so the government itself was like, you know what, we're going to get ahead of this, and we'll give our own motion to dissolve the government. Now, these bills have to be passed 3 times in the Knesset in order to become law and formally dissolve the Knesset. And then once that law is passed for the 3rd time, that triggers at least a minimum of 3 months until the next election. So even if this law is ultimately passed on June 1st, for argument's sake, that means that September 1st would be the first date that elections could be held. Keep in mind, there is a backstop of October 27th. The elections must be held by October 27th, regardless of when this law is passed, and the law would require elections between 3 and 5 months. So it could be any time between that period, and if the government votes to pass the law, and the law, the first reading of the bill yesterday was passed 110-0, so the government was like, yeah, sure, we have nothing to lose, because during that time period, elections are called for anyways. So the bill passed unanimously amongst those present in the Knesset chamber, those voting, and elections must be held if this law passes. Now, the government, and particularly Prime Minister Netanyahu, who wants to delay this as much as possible until that October 27th date, he might use political mechanisms to keep delaying the next 2 votes to try to get it so that at the end of the day, it will be completely moot as to when it actually passes. And so if UTJ, who their preferred date is September 1st, want elections by then, they will need this law to be passed by June 1st. It appears unlikely, based on the Knesset schedule, that this will get done by June 1st, which means that it's almost impossible that the elections will be held by September 1st. Now, keep in mind, Rosh Hashanah, I believe, is September 10th. So the following week, September 7th, Tuesday, September 1st, so September 7th would be the 8th, and Rosh Hashanah is on the 11th. So that September 8th election would be very, very unlikely, because it's 3 days before Rosh Hashanah. The following week would be September 15th. This is the date that Shas wants for the elections, because it is right between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It is the height of the high holidays. And Shas's voting base is about half, if not more than half, non-Haredi Israelis. And they want to maximize the votes that they get from this base of traditional Mizrahi Jews, who will kind of feel religious fervor during the high holidays and be more inclined to vote for a religious party during that time than they would be for, let's say, the Likud party, which is kind of like where these voters are. They're kind of between the Likud party and Shas. You know, they might vote for each one. They might want Netanyahu to be prime minister forever, but still vote for Shas. So that's kind of like where they want the elections, whereas Prime Minister Netanyahu wants the elections to be held on October 27th. He wants as much time as he possibly can use to finish the war in Iran, get any diplomatic victories that he can possibly get between now and then to maximize his potential to get as many votes as possible in the next election. So it's still not, you know, while yesterday's vote might seem very significant, 110 to nothing, yeah, we're going to early elections, it's far from a guarantee, though it is quite possible that it will be moved up by a few weeks.
Yesterday being Wednesday, yes. May 20th.
Correct.
Are you able to give us a few names and a little color of about the other candidates and the other parties that are putting forward their number one on their list to try to compete against Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been our prime minister for as long as most of us can remember?
So, sure. So you've got the opposition, which has been trying to get him out of office from day one. Of course, we had the joint party a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Yair Lapid joined Naftali Bennett's party. Naftali Bennett right now is the leading candidate on the opposition side to replace Netanyahu. Gadi Eisenkot and his Yashar party, which means straight, like somebody who's honest and trustworthy, straight. So Gadi Eisenkot is, his party has been increasing in population over in popularity over the past several weeks, whereas the new joint Bennett-Lapid party has been declining somewhat, according to a poll in Channel 12 yesterday. Bennett-Lapid are down to 23 seats together, whereas Eisenkot is at 16 seats. Likud is still the most popular party, Netanyahu's party, at 25. Gadi Eisenkot has been increasing popularity, and he is kind of trying to challenge Naftali Bennett for the title as leader of the opposition camp, as the main prime ministerial candidate for that opposition camp, whereas Naftali Bennett is trying to hang on to that title and to be the only candidate for prime minister in the opposition camp to basically the finalist against Netanyahu, if you will. But meanwhile, you've got someone like Avigdor Lieberman. His party, Israel Beiteinu, has been polling at about 9-10 seats. He said he's been doubling down on his insistence that he is a prime ministerial candidate, meaning he could look at someone like Naftali Bennett, who, after the 2021 elections, only 6 seats in his party, or at least the party that went with him. He had 7, but 1 left because he wouldn't agree to join the new government. He became prime minister. You know, he basically said, look, I'm in between here. I'm a right-wing party. I haven't ruled out sitting with Netanyahu. You guys want me to join you guys? Well, make me prime minister. And he was successful. And so Lieberman kind of sees that. Now, Lieberman is a very different situation because Lieberman absolutely will not sit with Netanyahu under any circumstances. He has said that many, many times and stood by that after several previous rounds of elections. But, you know, and he has said this before. You know, he has been a very shrewd political negotiator when it comes to these things. So he could be, you know, positioning himself for a good negotiation following the elections. But then again, the polls ultimately show that neither camp has a majority of 61 necessary to form a new government. And unless something changes, we could be headed to the cycle we saw between 2019 and 2021, where we had these four elections that didn't end up with any sort of result or any sort of clear victor. Now, we still could have a situation where there are more parties and more political unions formed. Right, we saw the Democrats were formed after the merger between Meretz and the Labor Party, and there are a bunch of parties polling under the electoral threshold. Among them, you've got Benny Gantz's Blue and White Party, you've got Yoaz Hendel's Reservists Party, and you have a lot of talk about a possible breakaway party from the Likud Party, kind of a Likud 2.0. Some former and current Likud members who are a little bit disgruntled with how the Likud has been operating over the past few years, particularly with regards to the Haredi draft law that they oppose. You know, you've got Gilad Erdan, who was the Israeli ambassador to the UN. You've got Yuli Edelstein, who's the current Likud Knesset member and former speaker of the Knesset. And they've been talking about forming a new party to try to siphon some votes away. And they would not rule out Netanyahu as the next prime minister, but they would kind of be on the fence and be like, hey, we could sit with either one. Benny Gantz also has not ruled out sitting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. He says we need a broad government. And so there has even been a report about the Gantz joining with these Likud breakaways and forming a party, though Gantz denied that report. So the political playing field is still far from set, and we'll have to wait and see. It's 45 days before the elections is when the parties are set, and they can no longer do mergers. They have to submit all of their party lists. And that's when we can finally look at it and be like, okay, this is what the playing field is going to look like. Now let's see what the polls say.
What's the date on that?
45 days before the election.
Okay, thanks for taking us through that. I want to go into something that hit Israeli news and was a stir in society this week, and that is National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir posting a video of himself antagonizing anti-Israel protesters who came on a flotilla. And in fact, the Israeli Navy actually went to meet them out at sea and brought them back here to Israeli shores. Take us through that flotilla incident and why his video was so shocking and disturbing for a lot of Israeli society, and certainly getting attention, negative attention on Israel around the globe.
All right, so earlier this week, the Israeli Navy went out to sea and they intercepted another flotilla. They did one of these a couple of weeks ago. They were able to intercept them off the coast of Greece, and basically Greece agreed to take them in so that Israel wouldn't have to detain them and then deport them. In this situation, they left from Turkey. They were intercepted between Cyprus and Israel, brought back to Israel some 430 activists. Now, it bears mentioning that the military has gone out of its way over the several rounds of flotillas to, while abducting them, to do so in the most, you know, humane way possible, because, you know, they don't want the images we saw, if those of you who remember the Mavi Marmara from several years ago. In that situation, the flotilla activists were actually quite violent, and they fought against the naval forces that came on, and they had no choice but to defend themselves. Thankfully, in these situations, that has not recurred, except for some isolated incidents, but those were not done with weapons.
Can you give us just a taste of what happened in that initial incident? Because I believe that it's relevant.
So
from years ago.
It was 2014. There was the first flotilla that came, and they were going to break the blockade. The Navy came on, and the Navy actually was underarmed. They did not think that they would be running into armed activists on these boats. I think they had handguns, but none of them had like their actual rifles. And they were attacked viciously by the activists. The military had to fight back, and there were several activists who were killed in the fights with the troops. The troops at the time were talking about how they were trying to shoot at people's legs to avoid killing people, but and then ultimately President Obama at the time had, so maybe this was before 2014.
It was 2010.
2010, yes. And then President Obama wanted Prime Minister Netanyahu to apologize to President Erdogan of Turkey for the operation, for the loss of life. And ultimately, Netanyahu acquiesced and did that, which was a very unpopular move in Israel, to say the least, because the soldiers there were defending themselves. In any event, after the war started, this current war, we have seen many rounds of flotillas coming, you know, just basically trying to make a scene. They're not coming with any significant amounts of aid. You know, the truckloads of aid that are going into Gaza every day are infinitely larger than whatever it is that they're bringing on these boats. It's to make a political statement, to make a scene, and to draw attention to themselves. Now, so the military has been making a concerted effort not to let this attention, to let them make a big scene about this situation, and they've been largely successful over the past several rounds of flotilla incidents. Now, once they're brought to Israel, they're transferred over to the police. Itamar Ben-Gvir is the National Security Minister. He is the minister in charge of the police, and so once they're under his purview, so to speak, once they're in the police custody. And so what we saw yesterday was the activists were on what appears to be a boat that was docked in Ashkelon. I guess they just docked in Israel. They were all handcuffed and held down and forced to lay down, while he was walking through them, saying that we are the landlords here, and, you know, saying that this will not, you know, we're not going to allow this to happen. He was
waving
his flag.
Israel.
But he was waving the Israeli flag. The Israeli national anthem was being played. And this was condemned. Pretty much anybody who addressed the issue in Israel condemned it. Obviously, many, many, many countries around the world condemned it. Many countries summoned their Israeli ambassador to ask for a clarification of what's going on here. And Ben-Gvir defended his actions. He's saying that we cannot allow these sort of actions to happen. We need to show them who's boss. And we are a sovereign country, and we're entitled to do this. Whereas, the prime minister condemned it, said this does not reflect Israeli values. The foreign minister had very harsh words for Ben-Gvir in a statement that he put out on X. And one foreign ministry official who was not named said, went so far as to say that Itamar Ben-Gvir has partnered with, something along the lines of him partnering with Greta Thunberg, who's the famous activist, has been on a couple of the flotillas, and basically advancing the agenda of these flotilla activists, because this is exactly what they want. They want to demonize Israel, and what he said was that this basically fulfills exactly what they want to happen. Now, keep in mind, why is Ben-Gvir doing this now? Well, we've got an election in the next few months, and he wants to pander to his base, and he showed that he takes a tough stance against terrorists, against supporters of terrorism. I mean, these aren't terrorists, but you can make the argument there are supporters of terrorism, certainly. And he wants to show that he's taking a very big stand against them, and so this perhaps does well amongst his supporters. Though I did see one person who posted today, somebody who said that he voted for him in a previous election, and he will not vote for him again because of this scene. You know, there are people who voted for Ben-Gvir because they thought that he would take a strong stand against terrorism, and they wanted to see that, but they didn't want to see these sorts of antics. There are others who support this, and I've seen comments on the videos that I've posted about this saying that, no, this is great, that what he did is we need to show them who's boss. So again, ultimately, the polls, the elections will determine whether this was a smart move on his part politically, whether it was a smart move on his part diplomatically and in Israel's best interest. Well, the overwhelming majority of Israelis would say no.
Well, it certainly got made headlines here in Israel. So thank you for taking us through it and giving us a bit of an understanding as to why that might have happened, the different perspectives. Thank you.
You're welcome. What are your plans for Shavuot?
Oh, thank you for asking. So Shavuot is upon us, and this is the holiday that we celebrate receiving the Torah. And tonight I'm actually hosting a program for the Olim organization that I run. When I say Olim, I'm talking about internationals who have decided to make Israel their home and come back to the land and taken citizenship. We call them Olim, meaning that they rise up.
Made Aliyah.
Like that they're, the idea is that they're like ascending to the land, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to do a night of learning with our director, Rabbi Jonathan Feldman, and I'm going to be there to facilitate the talks. We're having a few talks between 9:30 and 1:30 in the morning, because it's pretty common in Israel and in Jewish communities around the world to stay up late studying Torah on the evening of Shavuot. So I'm pretty excited about it. I'm in my holiday gear already so that I can rock and roll over to the program. What are you doing for the holiday, Binyamin?
So I'm actually in New York right now. Going to go to services and TBD as to what I do after.
Got to keep it open. Got to keep yourself fresh.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Chag Sameach. Happy holiday. And it should be good.
Take care. Have a nice weekend.
You too. And now for a Torah Thought by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York.
Chag Sameach. We're coming up on Shavuot, which is this Thursday night and Friday in Israel. And Thursday night, Friday, and Friday night, and Saturday outside of Israel. And Shavuot is a very interesting holiday in the sense that it's, in a certain way, not really connected to anything, because the Passover is connected to the Exodus of Egypt. The holiday of Rosh Hashanah is connected to the New Year. The holiday of Yom Kippur, when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai and the Jews are forgiven of their sins. Sukkot, the clouds of glory that surrounded them as they left Egypt. And so too other holidays have their reason. But when it comes to Shavuot, it's just that we are supposed to count 50 days after Passover, and then there's a holiday. Now, it happens to be that when that happened, they counted the 49 days, the 50th day, they received the Torah. But when you look at the description of the holiday of Shavuot in the Torah, it just says, count 50 days, and then it's a holiday. And that holiday is, in a certain sense, more important than the other holidays. Why? Because all the other holidays celebrate something. But here, on Shavuot, it's just a holiday. It's just to be celebrating with God. In a certain sense, it is connected to the Exodus of Egypt because, you know, after Passover, you count 50 days. But the holiday itself is not a commemoration of the Exodus of Egypt. It's just that 50 days after, you have a holiday. And so we're just celebrating together with God, which is very apropos that it's the holiday of the giving of the Torah, because that is when God chose the Jewish nation, gave them the Torah, and said, here, this is my special plan for you to carry out this Torah. And so this Shavuot, think about how we're not celebrating for this reason or for that reason. Yes, it's connected to Passover in a certain sense. Yes, it is the celebrating of the giving of the Torah. But more importantly, it is the celebration of the Jewish people being one with God. And since I've been on this theme of Haftorahs all year, the Haftorah for Shavuot is a very tremendous Haftorah. It describes, the prophet Ezekiel is describing the chariot of God and this heavenly vision that he has, angels going up and down and chariots and wheels and like a rainbow. And it's this amazing vision that seemingly has nothing to do with anything. But the truth is that it says that on the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, the heavens were opened and the Jews were able to see, so to speak, the heavenly realms. And this is a vision of what they saw on that Shavuot, because there was no separation between God and the people. They were just completely one and united. So we should be united with God and, perhaps more importantly, united with each other. Because when we received the Torah, we took upon ourselves not just the commandments of the Torah, but also the idea that we are all guarantors for each other, to help each other keep the Torah, to help each other stay upright and righteous and help one another. So this Shavuot, connect to your community, connect to your people, and connect to God. Chag Sameach and Shabbat Shalom.
All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Today is Thursday, May 21st, 2026. Tel Aviv has a low of 21 degrees Celsius and a high of 22 degrees. That's 69 degrees Fahrenheit for the low, going up to 71 degrees for the high. We are everywhere. Don't forget to sign up for our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with the top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week. And of course, it has a personal note from me at the top. You can sign up for that at israeldailynews.org. Scroll down to the bottom of our website and drop your email address in on the bottom right. Big thank you goes out to our incredible sponsor, Marianne Vollinger, our writer, Perry Schwartz, and our associate producer, Lori May. Have a great and productive day and an excellent weekend. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Chag Sameach. Happy holiday. Happy Shavuot, everyone.